For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, this story tonight is where a lot of people are asking this question right here. Why this waste? Why? There's actually three parallel accounts of the story. We're going to look at all three because by looking at the other accounts, you pick up little details maybe that one included that the other didn't. You might want to just stick a little piece of paper or something in each one of these if you've got your Bible. One's John 12 through 3, then there's one in Mark 14, 3 through 9, and then of course, Matthew 26, 6 through 13. Let's start out reading in Mark. Let's read the Mark one first. Verse 3, while he was sitting at Bethany in the home of Simon the leper and reclining at table, there came a woman with an alabaster vial, a very costly perfume of pure nard. She broke the vial and poured it over his head and his feet later we find as well. But some were indignantly remarking to one another, why has this perfume been wasted? This perfume could have been sold for over 300 denarii and the money given to the poor. And they were scolding her. But Jesus said, leave her alone. Why are you bothering her? She's done a good deed to me. For the poor you always have with you, and whenever you wish, you can do them good. But you don't always have me. She has done what she could. She has anointed my body beforehand for the burial. And truly I say to you, wherever the gospel is preached in the whole world, that also what this woman has done shall be spoken of in memory of her. That's the story right there. Let's go back and look at this a little more closely. Back to verse 3. Okay, so he's in Bethany. That's right near Jerusalem, within sight of it, almost. And this woman that came, turns out later, she's Mary, the sister of Martha. That's who it was. She has a phial made out of alabaster. That's a semi-precious stone carved. And these phials, you know, are like the type with a thin neck, which you break it open and pour it out, and that's it. It's used. So this very costly perfume, which was very expensive in ancient times. They didn't know how to make it like we do today. And so we might wonder, why is this woman who was a single woman, we know her and Mary and Martha lived together with Lazarus in a house, so they were not living with their husband. And they did their own cooking and serving and so forth, so they were not of the wealthy gentry class. They were probably, you know, probably merchants or something. They were, so in this day, that would have been relatively poor. They were actually not wealthy at all. But here she shows up with this treasure. That was actually not that unusual. What you're seeing here is back in a day when you couldn't put money into a CD or, you know, an investment account. There was nothing like that. There was no Social Security. There was no, you know, retirement benefits of any kind. What happens when you get old, especially if you're not married and you don't have kids that can take care of you? You know, that it was dangerous. These were dangerous times, especially for women who were not trained like the men were, didn't have the careers like the men did, and could easily wind up destitute in old age. So families would often have these treasures that they would bequeath to a daughter. This was her dowry. This was what's going to keep her safe. And if her husband dies or something else goes wrong. And this one, this vial of perfume, may have been in her family for a long time. They keep passing it down as needed. And we know that, and you know, she poured it out. So here she just comes in and without asking or anything, just poosh, and pours it out. And everybody's like, oh my God. That thing was worth 300 denarii. And so they crying out, why did you foolish woman, what are you doing? Oh my God, it's already broken. It's wasted. And they're going crazy. She's kind of looking around like, you know, you can imagine, put yourself in her position. Everyone's down on her case. They're all standing around. And she's like, wow, did I mess up here? Well, we need to ask ourselves, you know, when they're saying, why this waste? What does waste mean? I'll suggest waste is when you give too much for too little. You know, if the candy bar is a 50-cent candy bar and you pay a dollar for it, you just wasted 50 cents. If the job takes an hour to do and you take 2 hours doing it, you just wasted an hour, right? So whenever you're putting in more than you're getting out, that's waste. And these people are looking over and they're saying, pouring perfume on Jesus. We know what the value of the stuff is. It's 300 denarii. A denarius would be a day's wage for a grown working man. So this is nearly a year's wage for them. Today, a full-grown man that's not a student is going to probably be making, you know, $40,000, $50,000 a year. Maybe much more than that. So although that this would have much less buying power in terms of exchange rate or whatever, that's how dear it was to them. It would take them a year of work to earn that much money, just like it would take us a year to make $40,000. That's the kind of money. This is what it looks like to them when she breaks that, and this is why they're upset about it. So we see the basic proposition here, and so one of the things that we have to wonder, who are these people who are saying this, why this waste, and are bitching this lady out? Let's go to the John 12 version, starting in verse 3. Let's see. Yeah, this was the same. The hair, name's Mary, that reveals that it's her, with her hair, and the house was filled with the fragrance. But Judas Iscariot, one of the disciples who was intending to betray him, said, why was this perfume not sold and given to the poor people? Oh, Judas. Oh, yeah. Judas. That figures. He would say something. He would think that. You know, Judas probably looks, overhears 300 denarii, overhears Jesus. Why this waste? You know, for Judas, even if it was water she was pouring on him, it'd still be a waste. You know, he didn't have a valuation for Christ because he's not a believer. This guy, who never the disciple that never referred to Jesus as Lord, must have been awful good. We have no indication that he was a believer whatsoever, and he couldn't have been a believer, like it says right here. He was intending to betray him. If you knew who Jesus was, and if you believe that, then that's not something you would contemplate. And this guy had followed Jesus like others. You know, he had been following him for 3.5 years now. He was a bad apple the whole time, all the way back in John 6, fairly early in his ministry. Jesus said, did I not choose the 12 of you? And yet one of you is a devil. Jesus knew he was a bad apple the whole way through. He was never confused on that. But Judas. So why would he follow Jesus around all this time? In all likelihood, he was like so many others who believed, if this guy is the Messiah, then he is here to start a kingdom. He's going to take over. We're going to crush the Romans. They'd seen him perform miracles. He had raised a guy from the dead a week or before this. They'd be like, you could go out with an army, and even if they all got killed, he could raise them back to life and come at you again. You know, there'd be no stopping these guys. He definitely had the power to lead the kind of revolution that people wanted to see. And yet, as time went on, it was becoming increasingly clear that Jesus had no intention of doing anything like that. Especially this past week, when he had alienated all of the leadership of the whole country in those confrontations we just studied in 23, 22, and 3, and 4, just totally blew away, you know, the entire leadership of the company, the religious leaders. And, you know, it just was now becoming crystal clear that the whole kingdom idea wasn't going to happen. Now, guys that had followed him thinking, if he takes power, I'm one of his guys, that's going to mean I have power. And so, you know, we'll be like the cabinet. We'll be like the right hand and the left hand. John, James and John, that type of thinking. Now, he finally realizes he's not going to do it. He's a weirdo. I've been a chump this whole time. So I'm just going to get out of it whatever I can. And what he could get was 30 pieces of silver. You know, a few thousand bucks. And at least he had a little token to take home with him for all his wasted time. People try to picture Judas as this guy that, you know, sold out Jesus because he thought that was what Jesus wanted him to do or something like that. It's a lot of horse crap. Where do the 30 pieces of silver fit into that theory? Think about it. And yet, this, you know, just shortly after this, at the Last Supper, Jesus says to the 12, one of you here will betray me. And you would think, you know, 11 heads would just rotate around down to Jesus and say, oh, dude. So it's come to this. Didn't happen. Not even one person guessed, is it Judas? No. They sat there and said, it's not me, is it? That's how good he was. Not a single person suspected him of being a false believer. And yet he was as false as could be. And so, that's that thing we studied last week about the idea of the nominal believers that hang around. They look just like the others. Judas was like that. Judas then stands for the world. The world that knows not God, that doesn't know God, doesn't believe in him. And to them, you know, the world will look on and they'll feel like, you know, if you want to have some Jesus or whatever, you want to get into some religion, it's probably, you know, that could be a good thing. And, you know, that to have a place in your life for a certain amount of religious goodness or something, something that helps you sleep at night, that's fine. As long as you don't get carried away with it, you know. You got to keep things in perspective. And so this whole God thing, you know, if that makes you feel better, it's cool for you. But if anybody ever starts to get like caught up to the point where they're like, you know, I'm going all out to live for the Lord. Then they're like, why this waste? You know, come on, that's fanatical. You're in a cult. There's something wrong with you. And we've had many people here grow in their excitement for following Christ and knowing him personally and have had their own family and their own friends coming down on them like a ton of bricks. Like, what are you thinking? Let's get back to the things that matter here. Money, career, prestige, and so on and so forth. And so, it all depends on your perspective, on your value system, where you're coming from. I'll suggest that in the world, although people don't like to say it like this, if we can believe our Bible, the agenda of people in the world is really self. It's what's good for me. And this was certainly the case for Judas, as we see in verse 6. John says he said this, not because he was concerned about the poor, but because he was a thief. And he, as he had the money box, he used to pilfer what was put into it. He's stealing. I suppose Jesus must have told him this later. I'm sure they didn't know about it at the time. And so much for the, oh, we could have taken care of the poor with this, the real agenda underneath, what's in it for me. And so we have the perspective of the world. Now, that's interesting then. What is your starting point? That tends to determine your finishing point as well. How about the story Jesus tells in Luke chapter 12, 16 to 21? He says, he told him a parable saying the land of a certain rich man was very productive. And so he began reasoning to himself, saying, what shall I do since I have no place to store my crops? Man, this guy not only is a landowner, which was the elite then, but he's also very obviously successful in agriculture. I got so much grain, I don't have room for it all. And he said, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to tear down my barns, and I'm going to build larger ones, and then I'm going to store all my grain and all my goods. So he's got multiple barns. He tears them down, builds big ones, giant silos, fills them up with grain. And then I'm going to say to my soul, you got many goods laid up for many years to come. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry. So here we have a picture of a guy, okay? He's wealthy, he's successful. I think our world would look at this guy and say, you know, son, there you go. There's success. That is a successful man. Do we mean spiritually successful? Nope. Is it that he's relationally successful? Nope. It's that he's materialistically successful. And so in our world, as probably back in theirs as well, that's what really matters. Here is success. So much grain, you don't know what to do with it. You've got to build bigger granaries to hold it. And, you know, grain would be better than gold in that day. That was really cash. And finally, he's got so much you just can't even spend it. Okay, anyway, you know, I'll never spend this money. I might as well eat, drink, and be merry and take my ease. Because you never know what's going to happen. And so you build this vast, you know, empire, this agricultural empire, and then you're independently and incredibly wealthy, and then you just eat and drink and party. Hedonism takes over. Yes, and I do think this picture would come under considerable admiration in our day, as it probably did then too. Not from God, though. God came in and said, you fool, this very night, your soul is required of you. Now who's going to own all this stuff you prepare? And so Jesus said, so is the man who lays up treasure for himself when he's not rich toward God. Boy, there's a little different perspective. All this work, this was years of building this guy had put into this. And so he just finally completes his empire, and all of a sudden, God's like, fool, fool, fool. You've spent your whole life doing this, and now in a moment, boom, it's all gone. You, come here with me, book naked. The same way you came into the world, you come right back out that way. All this stuff you've got, somebody else is going to get that. What a chump. What a loser. And, you know, I can see what he's saying. You know, if what we're saying is true, that God is real, if Jesus is who he said he was, the Son of God, the Messiah, then getting carried away with something that is eternal is hardly foolish. Neither is it wasteful. Was it Mueller who said, he is no fool who gives away that which he cannot keep in order to gain that which he cannot lose? Good point. And another guy, I think it was Moody, who said, you know, if Jesus is not real, then we've all gone way too far already. But if he is real, we haven't gone nearly far enough. Well, there's a lot to think about here. Some people might want to give themselves to material avarice, like this guy, building up money, you know, buying, having that big house, fabulous cars. Others might just want the prestige of just being admired. You know, they're such a great scholar, as such an awesome musician, or so, whatever it might be. You know, how many silos do you have? I got 7. Mine are all full. And so there's this competition to see who's the most alpha male around. Sensual experience. That guy eventually went to this at the end, right? And the partying. But yes, just, you know, as much raw, you know, sensuality as I can get into. And I'm not going to tell you that none of these things are any fun, or that you, you know, would hate it if you were rich. Each of them have their, I will say that it's not going to be as good as you think. I'll say that for sure. But each of them have their pleasures for a season. The real problem is this: all of them are just temporary. Just, you can have that for just a little while, and then it's snatched away and you're left with nothing. What if this guy, what if this smart businessman had built all of his silos on top of a swamp, you know, filled with quicksand, and he got them built and filled up with grain? They began to sink and sunk out of sight and were all destroyed. You know, everybody would be like, you didn't check the soil before you built? How stupid can you be? And yet we're all in exactly that same position. When we give our whole lives over to something and it's only temporary, it's no, what's the difference? It all sinks out of sight. The moment that that day of accounting comes. And so, yeah, these are just two different viewpoints. They can't be reconciled. They directly collide. Two ways of looking at the world. Let's go to Matthew. Let's go to our version. Turns out there's more. Okay, let's see. Jesus, Simon, the Bethany woman came with alabaster. Well, it's the same story, all right, yeah. And we read that the disciples were indignant when they saw this, and they said, why this waste? Oh, so it's not just Judas, it's the other ones too. Now these guys, they're believers. They're actually authentic believers in Christ. Still, they think it's a waste, just like the others. It's like, again, here's that perspective that, yes, of course we're believers, yes. Yes, the Lord, you know, is important, and it's good to be in a church, you know, go to church, yes, that, of course you should do that, but, you know, these are things you have to keep in perspective, and, you know, getting carried away is never a good thing. You have to be balanced, and, you know, if something's starting to interfere with things like your career or things like this or that or the other thing, you know, that's, come on, it's like, you know, get a grip. And we'll hear this still from authentic, not pretend, not nominal Christians, but from authentic Christian believers will take this same position. Mary, get a grip. You're really getting carried away here. That was expensive perfume, all right? And that was your security. You just broke and did that with. I think these guys, frankly, this reaction is even stranger. It's harder to comprehend, frankly, than Judas. At least Judas, you know, he's in it for self. And anything other than self is going to be a complete waste in his mind. So, I mean, he's internally consistent. These guys, though, believers who also feel like, oh, you gotta weigh this. You know, you can't be too carried away here. Oh man, that is pitiful. I think it's pathetic. And someone else thinks that too. Jesus, actually, Jesus was the only person who had a different point of view on this entire thing. Back to Mark 14, Jesus said, "Leave her alone. What are you bothering her for? She's done a good deed to me." She's done what she could. She has anointed my body beforehand for burial. Anointing the body of Christ. Well, that's what those women, remember now, so yeah, there was those women on the Easter morning. That's how the Easter story comes out. It starts with four women going out with spices and stuff. That was, so this is ancient practice, okay? We today have death is away from us, out of sight. The dead body's taken to the mortuary. They inject the polymers there and mummify the body, you know, and the next time we see them, they're dressed and, you know, smiling in the casket. This is a little more earthy. Back in that day, death and dying was right there in the home. And people used to, like, this was kind of a show of kind of affection and reverence for the dead, to rub them down with these spices. They wanted to do this. Of course, none of them did they? It was too late. Jesus had risen. So in the end, only one person really ever anointed Jesus' body. And only one person ever got that honor of showing him that affection. And it was Mary. And it's because she didn't wait. She acted now. And so there might be a little mark there of something. Definitely there's something very spontaneous. It does seem somewhat impulsive what she's doing here. But Jesus says, and truly I say to you, wherever the gospel is preached in the whole world, that also which this woman has done will be spoken of in memory of her. So according to Jesus, this incident was more significant than people think. And true to his prediction, here we are still talking about it. 2011. There's something, what he's saying is there's something in what she did that I want people to mark that. You know, that's, there's something special, there's something awesome. And you know what it is? It's that point you can reach where you're no longer calculating, well, let me see, I could do this, but then I'd forfeit over here. Maybe I should go a little further, but not too much. And you're trying to, you know, figure out where to draw that line. And, you know, Mary just lost it. She just like, boom, and just leapt in, you know, just gave herself over to this. It was crazy. Crazy for God. Yeah. And Jesus liked that. That's a response that he likes. It's a response where I'm not going to calculate anymore. I'm just going all out. And so there's a real note of trust there. She must have trusted. You know, this is the woman. This woman right here, Mary, just a few days before had seen with her own eyes her brother, who had been dead for 4 days, raised from the dead by Jesus. So she wasn't guessing, I hope he's the Messiah. She knew who he was after that. They all knew. And so there's just this wild abandonment to Christ here that is amazing. It's awesome. And Jesus liked it. Now, Mary is a real person, okay? She's dead now. And as a believer, when she died, she went to heaven. And we are eventually going to die, or the Lord will return, and we're going to go to heaven too. We will have an opportunity to talk with this woman. I believe that absolutely. I think we'll meet her. We can discuss. We'll have plenty of time to talk things over. So that'll be interesting. Someday we're going to meet Mary, mother of Lazarus. And so you're the one that did the thing with the nard perfume. And we might say, so tell me, Mary, was it worth it? What do you think she's going to say? Are you kidding? Are you kidding? I just wish I had 10 more of those I could have done that with. Look around you, pal. Yes, it was worth it. And so a different value system comes to pass. We read in chapter 12 of John, verse 3, that the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. John, who wrote this book, who was there that day, probably is thinking back and just thinking, man, that smell just permeated that house. Probably remembers as, you know, how odors are. He's writing long afterwards now. Author Watchman Nee, who's a pretty good writer and has a lot of biblical insight, but falls over into a little bit of allegorizing once in a while, said about this, he says this, that if you want the odor to go out, the vial has to be broken. And so that's kind of reading in a little metaphorical picture there, or allegorical picture, really. So I would not, I mean, it's tempting, but I don't believe in an allegorical hermeneutic. However, Nee is correct in his point, not from this passage. As Walter Kaiser liked to say, right message, wrong passage. And actually, we can take it straight from Paul's own words, that the outer man, that the vessel of clay must be broken so that we bear in the body the dying of Jesus so that the life of Jesus can be manifest. Chapter 2 of 2 Corinthians, he talks about how God constantly manifests through us the aroma of Christ in every place. To some, the sweetest smell they've ever scented. To others, a choking gas leading from death to death. All depends, same smell, but all depends on your orientation to your inclination, whether you're inclined to follow God or whether you're looking for excuses to keep him away from you. And truthfully, yes, a commitment from the heart, all out, unreserved, is the main condition for God doing that work of breaking the outer man and releasing the power of this aroma that impacts our world. Yes, that is brought up in one passage after another. Well, okay, so Mary had just seen her brother raised from the dead. I commented on that already. So she knew what was really going on here. We don't have that advantage. When he was raised from the dead, or just before he was raised from the dead, they were standing outside the tomb. Everyone had tears running down their face. This beloved man had died. Jesus could have prevented it. He was a healer. He could have healed him before he died, but he didn't get there in time, purposely, as it turns out. They're standing out there, and Mary came out and seized Jesus' cloak. She fell at his feet and seized his robe. She's hanging on to him on her knees, and she says, "If only you had been here, you could have saved him." And as she's weeping, and Jesus says, "Mary, your brother will live." Of course, he knew exactly what he was about to do. She's like, "I know he'll live in the resurrection of the dead. I mean, whenever all the believers get raised back to live in heaven and everything." And Jesus said, "I am the resurrection and the life. Anyone who believes in me will never perish, even if they die, even if they sleep," he says. He says, "Do you believe that, Mary?" I don't think it records her answer. But then he went over and shouted out, "Lazarus, come forth," and I came out of the grave. He was raised to life. Jesus demonstrated right in front of them that he was the resurrection and the life. And so she had seen this. If she didn't believe it before, she sure as hell did after that. Yeah, she believed, all right. And probably at a level, I mean, I think probably at a level that her faith went up by a quantum leap at that point. And this will happen with us as well. The more that we begin to experience the Lord, the more that the goodness of God begins to sink in with us. None of this is going to make any sense until you have a personal relationship with Christ, okay? What we're talking about here is something that applies to people who have had a personal encounter with God, that have started a real relationship with God through Christ. If you don't have that, you're just going to listen to this and just think, "This is crazy. I don't know what they're talking about. Why would they do this?" But when you come into that personal knowledge of God, when you have the living Christ indwell you through the Holy Spirit, things start to really look different. And what Mary did starts to make sense. Here's a quote by a very popular mega church pastor that someone sent to me, and I thought was pretty good. This guy is a pastor of a multi-thousand person church out in California. He says, "Last summer I came to a shocking realization that I had to share with my wife. If Jesus had a church in Simi Valley, mine would be bigger than his. People would leave his church to attend mine because I call for an easier commitment. I know better than him how to cater to people's desires so they stick around." Jesus was never really good at that, you know? True enough. He was the one that said, "Unless you forsake everything, you're not worthy to be called my disciple." He said, "You have to, him who would come after me, you have to give up everything." And, or to put it differently, if Jesus isn't Lord of all, he's not Lord at all. Yeah. Well, what we need is to start to experience the thrill of a committed life in Christ, because that will dwarf, that will shame the misery, the drudgery of mediocrity in a half-baked Christian walk. You know, frankly, nothing is as pitiful as a semi-committed Christian. They've gone too far to be of much use to the world, but they haven't gone far enough to be of any use to Christ either. They live in this limbo, resenting whatever they feel they've given up, and yet not feeling the joy of the Lord that comes when we completely give ourselves over to him without reserve. We're not spiritual enough to be used by God, and yet, we just sit around miserable. It's pitiful. I don't know what anyone feels attracted to mediocrity, to a halting devotion type walk. Frankly, if Christ isn't real, I'd rather go into the world and live it up, man. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we may die. Whatever. But if God is real, then he's real, and we got to come to grips with that. And frankly, a committed, radical life for Christ dwarfs blanks out this pitiful, half-hearted version of Christianity that characterizes all too many, frankly, in our world today. May God spare us from that. I remember when I was in California, I was going to graduate school out there. I was working as a repairman dash janitor in an apartment complex, and I was employed by this Jewish couple. In fact, the whole complex was made up of retired Jews, so it was really funny, you know, talking to them. Then great sense of humor and stuff, and the couple that I worked for really liked me, and I liked them, and I'd been trying to explain to them about Jesus. They didn't buy it, but they really liked me, and they were childless, and it almost seemed like they were treating me like a son. They would bring me in and have me eat steak, because they had, you know, preserved these special steaks and aged them for 40 days, and they wanted me to see what it was like and stuff like that. So anyway, we were great friends and stuff. And I guess they thought I was a good worker, too. I don't know how true that was, but must have been better than the other guy before me. Anyway, so they said, I told them that I had considered going on to get a PhD at the time. That I was thinking about that. And so they, one day I came in, and they had one of these meals for me before I went to work. And they sat down and they said, "We want to make a proposal." And they said, UCLA is a great school. You could go there, get your doctorate. We will give you a luxury, one of the luxury units in this building to live in. And then you can, continue on doing your job here. And we'll give you a big raise too. And I was like, you know, that's a really generous offer. I really appreciate that. But I said, I'm just going to put you out of any question on it immediately. I'm not going to consider it. I'm sorry, I won't be able to do that. And they're like, well, why not? I said, well, I have to go back to Columbus. And there's this, you know, my group back there is waiting for me. I need to get back to them. And they're like, well, isn't this group you're talking about, didn't you say it's 50, 60 people? And I was like, yeah, but probably. And he said, well, you know, I mean, they'll be all right. How are you going to pay and what are you going to do for a career? I was like, I don't know. I'm actually thinking about going into house painting and get some of the guys. We'll probably start a business and I'll do that. And you just saw this look. And it was just, you know, on the verge of tears is what it looked like. And their faces just said, why this waste? You're such a sharp young man. Why this waste? What a tragedy. And, you know, they tried to be polite, but it just hurt them that I was going to throw my life away this way. Well, there's two ways of looking at the world, I guess, huh? I didn't regret it then. I don't regret it now. It's almost 40 years later. I'm happier today with that decision than I've ever been. And this joy of the Lord that I'm referring to is really something. You need to get into that. And if you don't know Christ in a personal way, you should call out to him tonight. Just let him know the intention of your heart. I want to know you. I want to be forgiven. I want to know what this relationship with you is, this thing. And he's eager. He will give you what you ask. And then you can find out why someone would do something as crazy as Mary. And that's as far as we're going tonight.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.